I was able to get an 18% increase in sales, almost like that. Whether you're a store or whether you're an airport, the is a potential guerrilla marketing opportunity.
Today on Influence Anyone, I'm joined by Paco Underhill. He is the best-selling author of Why We Buy and the godfather of retail behavioral research. The next time you walk into a store, think about how every single item and every cart, every shelf is placed strategically to influence your purchase decisions. His work has transformed how these brands think about space and the subtle cues that drive billions in commerce. So today you're in for this treat. We're diving into how our environments silently shape what we notice, what we want, and what we buy. I'm Howie Chan, influence strategist and founder of The Behavioring Company. Let's get into it.
It is organizing. It is presenting a solution as opposed to an item. The 20th century role of branding and marketing is over the past 10 years, our largest clients have been digital.
And this is both online and offline shopping?
Yes.
What are the three things any business owner needs to remember?
First is solution selling. Second is to recognize value. And third is
Paco, first of all, welcome to the show. Let me start with this. I'm going to play something 15 years ago. Let me see if you can hear this.
And I wanted to start today's session by talking about a bromance between a man and a pair of shoes.
So, Paco, when I heard that, I couldn't help myself but to ask, what is the story between a man and a pair of shoes, and what has that got to do with designing environments for influence?
One of the things that I always maintain is that we spend too much time staring into screens and not enough time standing up and walking through whatever the environment is. And I'm a big proponent of the difference between sitting or learning sitting down and learning standing up. And learning standing up is in part based on the comfort of your shoes.
That's amazing.
I never wear leather-soled shoes anymore. All of my shoes are rubber-soled.
So, Paco, you have studied and practiced in the world of environment design for influence. How did it all begin? I know it started, you started working with Citibank, but what was the origin story of your work, Paco?
Many years ago, I worked for the great American urbanist William White, who was the author of The Organizational Man, City, The Last Landscape. And it was an introduction for me into geography issues. I went on from there to teach in the doctoral program in environmental psychology at City University and modified some of the tools that I had learned working with William White to go from looking at cityscapes to looking at interior spaces. I realized that I could take the urban planning skills and be able to take them into stores or banks or airports or hospitals or train stations and start to deconstruct how they worked. I had never worked in retail. But part of what was really telling is that almost from the first day on the job, I could come up with often painfully simple issues that someone could do and see immediate results. And if you think of the retail consulting firms, they all tend to focus on strategic issues here, meaning that here is something you should think about doing next year. Whereas we were able to come in and go, here are 10 things that you could do tomorrow. Here are 10 things you could do next week. Here are 10 things you could think about doing next month. And here are a bunch of issues that you should think about in terms of the strategy a year from now. But the ability in commercial settings to be able to come in and create immediate results was something that just went across the world really quickly. And part of what it meant is that for somebody with no background in retail, no background in marketing, once we started winning victories, the word got around really quickly. And we had a group of probably 20 people who based their career on hiring us.
Was there a threat? Was there a commonality between, so when you start working with them and you start seeing these results, are there opportunities that bubble up as common ones, or is it very different per context?
First of all, what are the biological constants? What are the things that don't change? So if you think of it, 90% of us are right-handed, right? Our eyes age in the same way. I may be 6'4", my lovely wife may be 5'3", but the ratios of hand to mouth, the ergonometrics of the human body, are going to stay the same for the foreseeable future. Yeah, one of the things I'm very conscious of is that in both retail and commercial spaces, there's an evolution that happens with us. And that what made a good airport in 2000 and what makes a good airport in 2025 is different. And it's a reflection of the evolution of us. And there are a series of issues, whether we're in Singapore, whether we're in Dubai, or whether we're in Minneapolis, that are consistent in terms of change.
Paco, what have you seen that the changes that are most significant within the past few decades?
There are six things that we track. First is that the evolution and the connection between the real world and the cyber world has gotten more complicated. And that's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And if I walk into a grocery store, the number of people with their phone in their hand is often more than 50%. If I think about people shopping online, they're often shopping online because they want to find something in the real world. So that line between the physical and the cyberspace is something that's going to continue for the time being. So that's one. Next is the role of gender. And we have uncoupled sex from procreation. The role of what men are and what women are have gotten a lot more complicated. And one of the issues that we're dealing with, particularly in the commercial design world, is what makes something female friendly. And there are often some very painful but simple issues about dealing with women that are very different from dealing with men.
What's an example, Paco?
Howie, when was the last time you had a creepy experience in a parking lot? I have no idea.
None. Yeah.
But if I asked your wife, when was the last time she had a creepy experience in a parking lot, she would have something that happened often within the past week or 10 days. I mean, that's one of the things to the broader big box retail world is that for women, the shopping experience starts and ends in the parking lot. But it's also a reflection of fashion. If you think about the U.S., 25 years ago, there were roughly 200 job descriptions in the U.S. Army, of which 180 of them were male only. Today, that ratio has changed dramatically. Women are in professions that they never were in 25 years ago. And therefore, the uniforms that they wear are very different. If you're going to work at a law office, you're often asked to blend in as opposed to stand out. Fashion issues have changed. And whether we're talking about stores or whether we're talking about airports or the design of housing, how come in virtually every airport across the world, there's a line at the ladies' room and no line at the men's room? If you think about the design of a men's room and a ladies' room, and you think about an airport where men and women are the same, the women's bathroom should be twice the size of the men's room. It's based on the amount of time it takes, the number of positions to do their business, and this is often interesting, is do men ever talk about bathrooms?
Never.
Do women talk about bathrooms? The answer is yeah. And whether you're a store or whether you're an airport, the women's bathroom is a potential guerrilla marketing opportunity, meaning that you could give out samples, you could do, but part of how he has been fun is as an aging, straight, balding man, to be able to sort of yell at the macho male airport managers and go, man, the ladies' room is a marketing opportunity. Why don't you think about it? And they'll listen to me in the world if it was somebody else. The third is generational, meaning that historically, the biggest difference was between men and women. And now, while that difference exists, the other differences that we're looking at is between me and my 20-year-old daughters. They process things differently. Getting me to try something and getting them to try something is a completely different exercise. So that's one. Next one is time and how loud the clock is ticking inside our heads. And particularly in a post-pan world, that role, I can watch somebody go online or watch somebody walk into a grocery store and be able to, based on their movements, be able to tell you how loud the clock is ticking inside their heads.
Oh, so how they perceive time and how is it controlling their behavior, basically?
That's right. If you think of your wife runs to the grocery store, my kids are in school, they'll be back at 3:30. I'm making choices about not only where I shop, but how I shop or whatever, based on that clock. And the last two is what is global and what's local, meaning that the way someone shops in Minneapolis and the way someone shops in Beltrami, Minnesota is different, okay? Much less between El Paso, Texas and Duluth.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're looking at is how do we understand local and what are the decision-making that happens globally, nationally, regionally versus locally. And then the final one is the role of money, which is money has lost its peaches and cream complexion.
Tell me more.
Here's an example. If you go to the makeup counter at Selfridges in London or at Planton in Paris or even at Bloomingdale's in New York, the range of skin tones is very broad. And we passed over a very magic moment in the mid-1990s where the overwhelming majority of global wealth was in a much more disparate cross-section of people, whether it's Carlos Slim in Mexico City, whether it's Jack Ma in Shanghai, or whether it's Murakesh Bani in Mumbai. And I think one of the most interesting ways to look at this is to go to a shopping mall in Dubai.
To see the type of people who's spending the money. Yeah.
Yeah. The cross-section of people.
Very cool. Paco, when you look back at your work, when did you realize that shopping was more about human behavior and not about the products? When did you have that spark?
I think there is a trade-off within the context of categories, okay? Meaning that human behavior is part of purchasing just about everything, but some of it is a little stronger based on whether you're buying furniture or you're buying makeup.
Depending on the type of thing that you're buying, whether it demands more, maybe more weighing of cost benefit, that's more
durables versus consumables here.
Mm. Short term and long term. What does it say about humans in general? Like, why, in essence, why do we buy? What is it about our consumer behavior that you've learned over the years?
I think part of what it is that consumer behavior could be in part about what we wear. right? Which is staying warm, right? And staying clean. Another is about what we consume. The other is, how do we care about other people and how do we demonstrate that caring? And often demonstrating that caring is by gifting. I have a Turkish wife and I have Turkish mother-in-law and father-in-law. My Turkish is really poor. Do you know how I show them that I care about them? Is by giving them gifts. And it can be as silly as a t-shirt, or it can be as practical as an alpaca jacket to stay warm in New England as they come to visit.
So if we think about, you talked about this, where small changes can make these huge impacts. Was there anything in your work, Paco, that was super surprising that you didn't expect the big impact that it actually did? What are some examples?
Was the recognition that I can still walk into virtually any space and be able to point to something that should be changed. What was an education for me is understanding the dimension of the impact. So I can remember in one of the first jobs that I did, and this is something you may have heard me say before, of moving a brochure rack in a branch bank. And 2 days later, the branch manager is yelling at me, going, "Mr. Underhill, we got rid of a month's worth of brochures in 4 days. What am I going to do?" And I'm going, purpose of the rack is to put brochures into circulation. If you need more brochures, you're going to have to order them.
Where did you move it? Where was it and where did you move it?
I was basically understanding that many people were more likely to pick up the brochure rack on their way out the door than on their way in. And that if it was to the right of somebody exiting, then it was more likely to get picked up. There it is.
This idea that 90% of people are right-handers, so on the right, they'll pick it up.
I can remember working for a drugstore chain and seeing the number of people standing in line at the register with their arms full of stuff and going, why aren't they using baskets? We have baskets. There are baskets here. And going back and realizing that if we adjusted where the offering of baskets were, the number of people picking them up would go up dramatically. And I was able to get an 18% increase in sales, almost like that.
With the baskets, by placing the baskets in the right places. Yeah. Paco, I think this will be fun for people who are listening to this. So I think everybody has been to a grocery store before. If you help us, it will be good for you to narrate what goes through your mind. So if you were to help a grocery store improve sales, when you step in, maybe it starts from a parking lot. What are you thinking about? What are you looking at? Walk us through, almost like holding our hand.
There is a new grocery store in Westchester, which has a number of things in it which I approve of. First is that when you walk in the door, there is a fixture that says tonight's dinner. And there's a meat, there's a vegetable, and there's a starch. So that you could walk in the door and go, all right, tonight's dinner, and walk out the door. It is organizing. It is presenting a solution as opposed to an item. And this is one of the things that particularly the Spanish fashion merchants have done a really good job, Zara and Mango, where they have organized the store where they go, this top with this bottom, with these shoes, with this accessory. And it looks painfully simple. And yet I've walked through US and other fashion merchants through and go, could you duplicate this? Or could you model something after it? Why is in a grocery store, why is milk the farthest thing away from the front door? In the 1930s, the reason why milk was in the back of the store was to get you to move to the back of the store and then from the back of the store to the front, because the more things you passed, the more likely there was to buy something.
And there's no longer the case? There's no longer the how people buy today?
No longer the case, but if you think of it in many European settings, I can buy milk from a vending machine, something that doesn't happen here in the U.S. But there are basics that govern how we shop and what we shop for. I love this supermarket in Westchester because, for example, they will have all the salad makings and dressings in the same place.
Solution-oriented. If I were to make this thing, give me all the things to make that.
It's based on the premise, I want to propose this. And you know what? For many of us, the idea that lettuce, peppers, carrots, and snow peas and dressing are all in the same place, and they go, I would have never put snow peas in my salad, but that looks like a great idea. And part of what that does also is to add to the enjoyment. Because as you look at solutions, it gets you thinking. Anyway, I think also just one of the things that's sad, particularly here in the U.S., is that if you think of a European peasant in the 19th century, over the course of a year, they would eat 80 to 90 different things because they often consumed seasonally. You know what the typical American consumes over the course of a year? It's often less than 25 things.
Oh my gosh.
And one of the things when I go lecture students or whatever, I go, one of the ways to improve your diet without doing a lot of research work is to try and consume as many different colors over the course of a day as you can. Different shades of green, different shades of red, a little yellow, purple. What's purple? Eggplant. Just all of those. But it's also from our standpoint is that, Howie, if you walk in to a supermarket in Minneapolis in February, where are the freshest vegetables and freshest fruit? Are they in the produce section? They're in the freezer, sir.
So as you walk through the store, so that's great. So when you come in right away, there's something that tells you what you should do, a solution. What else is happening as you walk through? I suppose like height, like where things are placed are super important.
It's height. It's also somebody sampling. Sampling is there to get your saliva glands working. And it isn't to get you to buy what you sampled, but if your saliva glands are working, you end up buying more.
What else is going on? Lighting is obviously a huge component. Hey, quick break here. Before Paco shares some interesting ideas on how to engage our senses, I want to tell you this truth. Everything that you want requires someone else to do something. And whether you realize it or not, you're already influencing people today, whether it's your friends, your team, your clients, your family, your boss. The real question is, though, do you know your natural influence style, the one that you default to, even when it works against you? In the past 8 months, I've created an assessment, a simple assessment to help you find out. In just 3 minutes, you get your custom influence profile, your strengths, your blind spots, a personal PDF report emailed to you so you can turn these instincts into your advantage. If you are someone who loves to understand more about yourself, self-awareness is your thing, go take the assessment now. It's influencestylequiz.com or click on the link in the show notes. All right.
I think often it is trying to engage in all five senses.
And that's important.
In grocery, I think finding ways to get you to sniff, get you to taste, get you to look, get you to touch, get you to even hear. And one of the things that we've done with some of our clients is to go, is music meant to entertain your employees? Or is it meant to reach out to your customers? And knowing who's in the store on a Monday morning versus who's on a store on a Thursday night may govern whether you're playing Frank Sinatra or whether you're playing Death Cab for Cutie.
That's right. That's right. So the experience, obviously the experience of your customers So is it still, you want to keep them there because it's a good experience? Obviously, they come back, but you want to keep them there. They're salivating. They're buying more foods. They're enjoying their experiences.
That sound environment is a very subtle way of engendering loyalty. It isn't as if you walk out the door and go, oh man, that was, that I really love listening to.
Right. It's like a concert. I'm going to come back here and listen to music. Tell me more about that with the loyalty piece. How does music engender loyalty? What's happening?
Some of it is recognizing who it is that's in the store when, okay? And that having some cadence is something that many of us respond to positively. I am someone who music is an integral part of my life, even though hearing is a little damaged at my late age.
So cadence, like the beat, the rhythms of people coming in to the store, understanding that can help. Yeah.
I am told that I have the best motions on aging white man that someone's ever seen.
I'm very curious to hear your perspective on this. So for humans, you talk about how we can make things easier, simpler. Are we simply just responding to these sort of psychological tactics? Like, how are we moving through the world? Like, how do you see us as humans going into these stores? Are we just responding to all these different things without thinking?
Howie, I would like to think that we aren't victims, okay?
Yeah.
That we are people who are coming in with a certain degree of maturity about what it is that we're spending, how we're spending it, where we're spending our time, and making our choices. This is what being a responsible consumer is in the 20th century. And we need to consume better and smarter. We need to recognize the ecological consequences of many of our decision-making. And this has been something that in my later age, I have focused on, which is how do we get the broader public to be smarter about being consumers as opposed to merchants being smarter about being marketers. Whether I'm working for the Plant Protein Association or whether I'm teaching children about how to eat and how to eat smart and how to eat well is part of what our agenda is. And if it's just often simple things like, what's the first thing you should eat in the morning when you get up? Howie, do you have a cup of coffee or do you eat an apple first?
In the morning. I'll usually eat some kind of protein first off. Coffee's later.
Coffee is something that works better when there's something already in your stomach. Eating an apple first thing in the morning actually wakes you up faster than if you drank coffee.
Paco, it does seem like there are these two opposing forces, like you're saying, from the merchant side and from the consumer side. So from the merchant side, how should we look at influence through the environment, through where you place things, the design, for example, decision design, and have it be ethical? What does ethical design mean for you?
All right. One of the things which I will often point out is that the overwhelming majority of grocery stores are designed by men who are 5'9" and taller. And I can go through a grocery store and take pictures of women struggling to be able to pick things up. And the idea of what makes something female friendly is just better. Okay? That idea of organization, I think, is something that the grocery store was designed in the 1930s when there were a bunch of different things from where do I put the freezers? Where do I put the refrigerators based on electricity issues and whatever and all of it, which are in 2025 make absolutely no sense whatsoever. And therefore, it's time to do things better. We also know that the big box stores from Walmart, Target to whatever, which were conceived of in the 1970s, where so much of the space on the floor was storage. Whereas in 2020, 2025, with AI and data at the register, I can actually stock the same number of products in the store that's 40% smaller. And therefore, the circulation time and the time somebody has to spend, if you're walking down an aisle where there aren't 30 boxes of laundry soap, there are only five, that makes a difference. These are all things that are the talk about the evolution of technology, the evolution of organization, the evolution of the supply chain management, and what does that mean in terms of the actual flora of the store and the impact on the shopper. The customer is probably a better word.
A lot of it, as I hear you speak, is about coming up to speed and how people buy, the type of people that buy, obviously including and being inclusive of different types of people so that they can get what they want. It's almost, don't look at it as, you're not manipulating people to buy, but you're helping them to get what they need.
One of the things I'm just angry about at Costco, okay? I love the Costco brand. Why isn't there an aisle with all of the Kirkland products on? So I could walk into a Costco, go to the Kirkland aisle, buy everything that I can or need there, okay? And be able to, you know, use Kirkland soap, Kirkland laundry, also maybe even Kirkland t-shirts and underwear. I think this is one of the things that we're getting to, which is that the 20th century role of branding and marketing is in transition. And if you think of it, in 1990, if you walked up to the counter with house brands, it was a confession of your poverty. If you walk up to a register with house brands, with Kirkland products in 2025, it's a reflection of your smartness.
That's so interesting. Yeah, the self-identity has changed. Also, probably the positioning of these brands. I think all of them has tried this or is doing this. Like Whole Foods, for example, with their 365. It is doing tremendously well. You trust the brand. You trust where they got their things. They do it in bulk. So obviously, it's cheaper. And you become seen as a smarter shopper.
Whole Foods was one of the first national grocery chains to do a better job of making decisions locally, regionally, and nationally. So what decisions were made in Austin and what decisions were made in the Northeast had some value to it. And yeah.
So based on where they're located.
Yep.
The types of foods available, what's around them.
Yes. You think of it in Duluth, Minnesota, no one would buy kimchi.
But perhaps if you offered it as a part of a solution, maybe people would try it out.
If you offered it in New York City, we would have a Korean population and a offshore population that recognize fermented vegetables are really good for your digestion.
Right. Agreed. Paco, how does some of this stuff, you talked about online selling, obviously e-commerce, the interface between online and offline are merging and blurring. How does some of what you have been doing, how has that been applied to online environments that you've seen that works really well?
If you think of the 10 largest digital companies in the world, we have actively worked, and I personally have worked for 5 of those 10, including some global tours, looking at what is the difference between an African consumer, an Asian consumer, a Russian consumer, a European consumer, a Latin consumer on digital-based issues here. And digital isn't just about what happens on our phone, but it's the relationship our phone to the rest of the world. Samsung is telling us that in the not-too-distant future, our kitchens and our appliances in the kitchen are going to be able to keep track of everything that's there.
Yeah.
And they're going to be able to tell us, oh, Mr. Chung, it's time to get some milk. Mr. Chung, your red pepper is running low. And therefore, the role of the kitchen and the role of how we shop is going to be influenced by a kind of AI that we know is coming, but isn't here yet. We also know that if you're a major firm like this, the difference between the mindset of someone walking into a store in Albany, New York, versus someone walking into a store in downtown San Francisco is very different. And you may be selling some of the basically the same product, but some of the questions and some of the experience before they come in the store needs to be adjusted. And I think this is a very interesting issue in our digital world, which is it isn't as if there's a ubiquitous site, but maybe that site needs to respond to where somebody's logging in from.
It's something that's very local, very personalized to who you are, what you care about. So that experience is what you want.
I think this is also one of the poignant issues as we move forward in the 21st century, which is, what is the privacy line? Where is it that my information is public and is accessible versus what information is personal and mine?
If that were to happen, if you were to be served up something that's so specific to you, that means you are willingly, or at least not willingly, your information is almost given a compromise so that the merchant has all of that information to give you that. So do you actually want that? Does it make sense for you to do that? Yeah, that's a big topic of contention for sure, Paco.
Very big. It's a very big topic.
So a lot of my listeners are business owners, they're entrepreneurs. Let's say they're selling, most of them sell information products, courses, things like that. What are some truths or what are some must-dos if they were to sell their things? Like, how would a seller such as them take your knowledge and implement it in their world? What are some things that they must do?
Obviously, if you're Abercrombie and Fitch, you know who your target market is, okay? But if you're Bloomingdale's or your Ace Hardware,
it's pretty broad.
A store for 30-year-olds may not make a lot of sense. Okay? And it doesn't mean that you don't want the 30-year-olds in it, but one of the things, particularly in the context of our country and in Europe, is who has the money?
Yeah.
The old who has the money, or is it the 30 that has the
Absolutely. Yeah. So focus on the segment that has the money. What is their age? What's happening with the physiology so that you can actually help them get the information that they need.
Recognizing that as I walk in a door from the parking lot,
right,
I am adjusting my walking speed, I'm adjusting to changing light, and I'm adjusting my peripheral vision. If I'm 25, I do those things quicker than when I'm 60, much less 73.
Yeah. You call that a decompression zone, a landing zone.
Landing zone or decompression zone. Yeah.
Right. Is there such a thing for a website or a landing page framework? Is there a digital decompression zone? How do we see that?
Over the past 10 years, our largest clients have been digital. And we have watched people shop or interact online. One of the premises, for example, Howie, within the beauty industry, is what is the difference between a 25-year-old coming to an Estee Lauder site who's been there 100 times, a 50-year-old who's coming to the Estee Lauder site for the first time? And recognizing that, yes, that 25-year-old is going to be potentially an important customer to you, but being able to understand the difference between the experienced visitor and the novice visitor. And that is a very interesting issue online.
What's an example of what they should do? So for a younger audience versus an older audience, what's a thing?
Some of it is the choice of models. Some of it is the scale of the typefaces. Some of it is the contrast between the colors of the typeface and the background.
Because makes
perfect sense to somebody who's age 30. And what makes sense to somebody who's age 60 is different.
And then when we think about landing on the digital space, what's being adjusted? Like, what's the translation, again, from a physical to a digital? What's happening there, Paco?
Some of it may be the use and choice of models and how the introduction works.
Tell me more. Super interesting. What's the introduction?
If you think of somebody coming to the first time, they may go, "Well, you a first-time visitor? If so, here are five things that you need to think about as you move through our site."
Gotcha. Yeah, help them start.
Yeah. Being friendly.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, it's like in the store. If you're entering a store in the first time, you would love to have someone say, "Hey, have you been here before? First time?" Then these are the things you need to check out. All right, if you need me, I'm here.
It's also, I think, one of the things I really love about Dubai is that on people's name tags, in many places, they list their language skills.
Oh, that's so helpful.
And whereas if you go into a U.S. store, we were able to do, for example, in a shopping mall in the Washington, D.C. area, which has a very cross section of people living there, is that in the front of the store, there was a little place where you got to list all of the languages that were spoken inside the store.
And that's great.
One of the ways that you engender loyalty, but it is also one of the ways in which you generate consumer buzz.
Yeah. This makes me think about when you talk about global, local, even within Minnesota or even within the Twin Cities here, there are different geographies within the cities that have different makeup of ethnicities. So if you were to be in a place, for example, a store that's at an intersection of some of these ethnicities, yeah, you will want to have some language that shows up. You wanted to speaking Spanish or speaking Somalian or some different types of languages so you can serve those people that's coming in. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
If you think of Toronto as ethnically diverse middle-class population of any city on earth. And one of the things that I really love is the way many Canadian merchants, particularly in Toronto, have responded to that opportunity. That having a halal meat section, for example, not only drives the sale of halal meat, but it drives the sale of laundry soap. Because the Muslim family will go to the store where they can buy the halal meat and then buy laundry soap and everything else that goes all along with their shopping basket.
Because that's the number one on their list. They need to fulfill that. And then everything else, we can just get it. Ah, that's smart. That's smart. What other, if you think about your learnings, Paco, you're talking about you work a lot with the digital companies. What other learnings maybe came as a surprise to you online, digital versus physical? Were there any?
I think some of it is also we did a lot of work in the China market. And it was interesting looking at the difference between first, second, and third tier cities.
Yeah, and it is very different within how they buy.
And how they buy and the level of sophistication. And I could take that same concept and be able to take it to the USA and go, what happens in Duluth and what happens in San Francisco has some very predictable differences.
And this is both online and offline shopping?
Yeah.
Yeah. What would be an example, Paco? Let's say it's an online. Like, what are they looking for that's different? How would they go about it differently?
Some of it may be, for example, the role of families and who it is that they're purchasing for. According to the last census, for example, less than 25% of American households had a mother, father, and dependent children in it. And part of what that means is that there are different parts of the country where the nuclear family still reigns, and there are different parts of the country where either somebody's living by themselves or they're living with three generations under the same roof. I think about my wife who is shopping for herself. She's shopping for her husband. She's shopping for her children. And she's shopping for her parents who are here. Don't speak English.
That's a very different thing if you're in New York City and you're just shopping for you maybe your housemates, but that's about it. It's a very small.
Well, also a recognition, Howie, that it's also what the role of money is. Because in the context of our home, is there money? The answer is yes, there is money. But skill set and the language skills between us and the truck driver and his family that lives down the road is a little different.
Yeah. It does seem like a lot of this is understanding the behavior of consumers, how they buy, how different it is, the similarities, the truths that stand the test of time, the changes in evolution of how we as a society evolve. If you were to boil it down to what you've learned, we maybe talked about this already, but what are the three things you think any merchant or any business owner needs to remember so that they're giving their customers sort of the best experience that they have, the best solution to build their brand? What are three things?
I think first is solution selling. Is not selling items, is selling a solution. Second is to recognize value. And third is that almost all of us, as we are moving forward, are recognizing that we need to be more eco-conscious, and that therefore some form of eco-awareness is one of the ways that you get the customer to trade up as opposed to trading down.
Give an example of that, Paco.
I have become a passionate advocate of alpaca. Okay. That as a person who grew up in a warm country, living in New England now, the idea that something is warm, light, and soft is remarkable. And I have thrown out almost everything else that I wear to stay warm other than alpaca. And while it does cost more, the value of it is something that is discernible to me. And I think one of the things that many of us are getting to, particularly those of us who are older, is fewer better things.
What you talk about trading up, it's really helping people see the value of things that can last a longer time, things that are more sustainable. Instead of this sort of mass consumption era, which is you buy and throw, like you keep buying new things. And actually, it drives me crazy too. We have a dehumidifier, which we had to buy and throw several times. And this is like a huge machine. And when I go research about why does it happen, it seems like it's just an industry-wide thing where these machines would just fail in 3 years. They just do. And what a terrible solution where you have to buy this huge machine and you have to lug it to the dump every 3 years. So I do agree. I think there has to be a shift. And I think gradually there is, to a less sort of mass consumerism mindset.
Yes.
And I think maybe it's also, I'm getting older as well. You know, less and fewer things that last longer definitely seems like the way to go.
It isn't just lasting longer, but they work better. Alpaca is something that not only do I wear the sweater, but if I get up in the middle of the night, I'm cold, I can put the sweater on and go back to bed. Could you do with a wool sweater? The answer is no.
That's why I also love the brand. For me, Patagonia is such a fantastic brand. In Minnesota, we have to have these huge parkas, right? Big jackets. And I bought one from them probably, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. And the zipper broke. And I brought it in and they asked me if I wanted to just exchange for a new one, but I liked the design. So they said, all right, we'll go repair it. And they do it for free for you because they know it's valuable to you and they repair it. And it's just part of paying a higher price for that jacket, but it lasts, it works fantastically well and they take care of it for life.
And the owner of Patagonia is one very impressive, eco-conscious guy. And the fact that he's built his brand and built the loyalty is testament to a 21st century logic. Let's go, bro.
Paco, this has been wonderful. I have a last question for you. You've spent your life studying how environments influence people. But when you look at your own life, what has influenced you the most? Is it a person? Is it an idea, a mindset, a belief, a brand? What is it?
I grew up on the road. We moved through my childhood into my 20s every 18 months. We changed countries, changed languages. And I think the coping skills that I grew up with have contributed to my career and have contributed to my ability now to be able to interact with the world. That's one. Second is I am 6'4". I weigh 195 pounds. I work out every day. I studied martial arts when I was young. I don't move through my life with a lot of fear. And for much of the past 40 years, when I'm in New York City, I have been a volunteer for Urban Pathways, reaching out to the homeless on the street. And that means that I can go up to a homeless person and I can talk to them. I can ask them questions. I can direct them to a place. And it is a kind of act to which I can get no direct thank you for, meaning that that homeless person is never going to be able to do something for me, okay? But the act of being able to do it is what we call a mitzvah. And I think one of the things that all of us need to do is to respond to what some of those needs are. And I am as happy as I am with my career. It is the act of going out and helping homeless people that gives me an inner warmth and a sense of satisfaction. So for all of my listeners, to us, Howie and Paco here, acts of kindness will come back to you in other ways that you have no idea about.
Paco, I appreciate you so much. You are a positive force in the world, not just in terms of the work, but also the way that you are. So thank you so much for coming on. You know you're talking to the godfather of retail behavioral research when he says something like this: I could walk into virtually any space and be able to point to something that should be changed and see immediate results. He reminds us that influence doesn't just happen with words, doesn't just happen with verbal communication. It's in the spaces that we create, the choices that we frame, the signals that we send without saying anything. If you love this, you will enjoy his book, Why We Buy. Go get What Women Want. They are for anyone who is serious about influence, especially if you're in retail. The links are in the show notes. And hey, if you made it all the way here, it says something about you. You are not just curious, you care about this. And so I want to bring in more legends, more experts like Paco, and I need your help. So if you would give a quick review and testimonial on the show, I would deeply appreciate it. And you'll reap the rewards by getting bigger and more experts onto the show. So please take a few seconds to do that. I am deeply grateful, and I'll see you on the next episode of Influence Anyone. Take care.